Mickelson had up the field for the World Golf Championships tournament that got underway today in the South Course at Firestone Country Club in Akron, Ohio. Mickelson is ending a six-week hiatus as he took to be with his wife and mother, who are both battling breast cancer. He says both are making extraordinary progress. The Chicago White Sox go for the sweep of the American League West, leading Los Angeles Angels this afternoon at U.S. Cellular Field. Left-hander John Danks on the mound for the Sox against Irvin Santana of the Angels. It's an off day for the two teams tied for the lead in the National League Central Division. The Chicago Cubs begin a series in Colorado tomorrow night, while the St. Louis Cardinals head to Pittsburgh for the weekend. And it may be the most relaxed championship around. More than 1,300 competitors are gathered in Springfield, Illinois for the 2009 World Horseshoe Tournament. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the sport's first world championship. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
James Woolsey was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency during the Clinton administration. The Environment reports Lester Graham recently talked with him. The current recession has caused the price of oil to drop, most think temporarily. Woolsey has been arguing that no matter what the price, dependence on oil is a national security problem that we need to solve.
Well, I think moving away from oil dependence, period, is extremely important for our security. And it's important because of climate change. We are funding both sides of the war on terror. Oil, when it comes into an autocracy or a dictatorship, tends to enhance the power of the state. Tom Friedman summed that up very well in his chapter in his new book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded. The chapter is called Filler Up with Dictators, and it's a pretty accurate statement. We also have run the risk of oil cutoffs, of terrorist attacks in the Middle East. Oil is just a very big national security problem for us, and it has a 97% monopoly on transportation. So we've got to break that monopoly.
It seems the only time you can get the general public's attention on this issue is during periods of gas price spikes. What do you think it will take to get a sustained effort at the personal level to become more energy independent?
Most major automobile companies are coming out with plug-in hybrids. Here before long, plug-in hybrids let you drive all electric for 30, 40, 50 miles before you then become just a regular hybrid using some liquid fuel. Three-quarters of the days an average American car goes less than 40 miles. You're driving on the functional equivalent of 50 to 75 cents a gallon when you're driving on electricity. And that, I think, is going to get people's attention and provide a real economic incentive to move toward plug-in hybrids if the upfront cost of the battery is taken care of by a tax credit or by leasing the battery instead of buying it or by some other financial arrangement, so people can then see they can drive on a lot less than the cost of driving on gasoline, whether it's $3 a gallon or $4 a gallon.
Now, you've stated your concern about climate change, global warming on several occasions. You consider yourself fairly conservative politically. I'm wondering what you make of the controversy in the debate that you recently heard in the House and what we're likely to hear in the Senate.
Well, I'm kind of liberal on domestic things and kind of conservative on defense and foreign policy things, which to me is a perfectly reasonable balance, but some people don't see it that way. I think possibly a very important part of warming and climate change is likely to be being produced, most climatologists would say, by the fact that we're pumping so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and trapping heat. That creates a problem. We still need to get the job done of stopping as much as we can something that could make the world a very, very unpleasant place in terms of the height of sea levels and so forth for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
I read an article in the Futurist magazine from the World Future Society, which explained you're doing a lot in your personal life to become energy independent. What's worked for you?
Well, we have photovoltaic cells on the roof of our farmhouse and lead-acid gel batteries in the basement and a plug-in hybrid. It's a little expensive, but you can do a lot these days to make it possible to operate your home, at least the key functions of it, even if the electric grid goes down because of an accident or some kind of hacking attack or something. And you can be at least partially independent. It's not ideal. It's not perfect. It's going to get better. It's going to get cheaper. But you can get started now if you want to.
James Woolsey is a former CIA director and is now a partner at Vantage Point, a venture capital firm. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Lester Graham is with the Environment Report. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. I'd like to share with you this afternoon in this portion of the program an excerpt from a new novel, The Crying Tree. Chapter 2, September 1983. She remembered the date, September 20, and the time, 6 p.m. The scent of the air was spiked with apples, and over by the river, geese were taking to the sky. Her son Shep, 13 and a half years old, stood in the field near the barn playing his trumpet, and her youngest, Bliss, was on the tire swing with her best friend, Jeff. And she, Irene Stanley, 32 years old and trim as a pin, was making her family dinner. Nate pulled up in their brand-new pickup, tugged off his wide-brimmed Smokey Bear-style hat, waved to his kids, banged through the back door, and smacked a U.S. map on the counter next to where she was cutting vegetables. That's how readers are introduced to Irene Stanley and her husband, Nate, in the debut novel from Nassim Raqqa, The Crying Tree. Irene and Nate have those two kids, a boy named Shep and a girl called Bliss. Nate is about to tell Irene they will be moving, leaving their rural southern Illinois home to move across country to Oregon. Irene makes the move reluctantly. After close to 2 years in their new home, she feels her family has made the transition successfully. At that very moment, though, their lives are headed for calamity. Shep is murdered in their home. The murderer is a young mechanic who, at the age of 19, has amassed a long criminal record. Daniel Robin is arrested, tried, and sentenced to death. Years pass, but the pain and grief are still knife sharp. Irene realizes the execution of Daniel Robin will not provide peace, will not stop her pain. And eventually, without telling her husband and daughter, she forgives her son's murderer. A review of The Crying Tree in the Oregonian newspaper says the novel is a colorful and creative biography of hate, about its insidiousness and ferocity, but also its fateful familiarity. Nassim Raqqa, an award-winning public radio reporter, is my guest in this portion of the program. Nassim, welcome.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
What led you to this topic?
Well, what led me to this topic is, just as you said, I was a public radio reporter in Oregon. And in 1996, I was assigned to cover the state's first execution in over 30 years. And in the process of getting ready to cover that story, and then subsequently after covering the story, I began to do a lot of interviews, both with people who were on death row, people who had been on death row and were later exonerated, victims, survivors, both people who were waiting for the death penalty or the person who were waiting for the execution of the person who had harmed that family member, and those who were against the death penalty, and also interviewed the people who were in charge of the execution process. And the whole process just brought so many questions to my mind. But by far, the most compelling people I met were those that had lost a loved one to murder, were living for that execution, seeing that it would hopefully provide some closure to their pain, and then saw their life disintegrating around them, that their hate, their anger, their anguish was just destroying them physically, mentally, spiritually. They were losing family, other family connections in their lives. They were losing connections to their friends. And they came to the conclusion that the only way that they could move forward was to forgive and sometimes even befriend the person that had harmed them. And that arc so startled me, dumbfounded me, and compelled me to want to tell that story and understand it.
Yeah. I can understand the anger and the hate, I can understand eventually coming to a place where you can forgive. But how do you make a friend of someone who has turned your life upside down?
That's a very good question. And I think it is just such a personal thing. Some people don't, but some people really do. And it's just a remarkable thing to be around when you are talking to these people who have come to the conclusion that, you know, this person has made a mistake in their life, a hideous, terrible mistake. Those people, when they have befriended them, those people are deeply remorseful of the mistake they've made in their life. And somehow the communication between the victim survivor and the perpetrator of the crime, you know, they've been through the darkest hour together. That both of their lives revolve around a moment in time that is absolutely their, both of their darkest hours. And somehow that brings them together. And I found this most closely in a friend of mine in town, in the small town I live in Oregon. And she was 70 years old when I met her. I met her at a peace rally in 2003. She looked exhausted. I asked her her name and why, if she was all right. She said, well, I just had returned from San Quentin. I drove the way home from San Quentin, where I was on death row visiting with the man who killed my daughter 24 years before. Mm. And then she told me the story of her coming to forgive and then eventually befriend this man. Mm.
Well, this novel really belongs to the character Irene, I think. And there's so much pain within her. It's palpable on the page. How did you approach creating this character so as to allow readers to gain a sense of the pain, the grief, the anger, and the hate she feels, and do it so it really feels real, it feels right?
I guess my style of writing is to see the nuances in people's behavior. I think that it's the small things that people do, where they turn their eyes, what they pick up, what they look at, what they dwell on in their thoughts, even what they cook, what they eat. I think all of these small things tell so much about a character, and it's the small things that you and I can relate to. And so I find that when I read other people's work, that I can relate to the characters when I can, when they're doing things that I do in my daily life. And so through Irene's character, through all of my characters, I believe that they become so real to people because those people are just doing the same things you and I do in our lives. And we understand what it means when she chooses, when she says, I don't have the energy anymore to do something that I normally would, whether it's to plant the garden this year. And you know she would always plant the garden or to wash the windows or just the simple things in life, but you know that her decisions speak volumes to her mental state. Mm.
Before readers come across the Stanleys and Irene Stanley and Nate Stanley, they're introduced to the superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary, Tab Mason. He's the first character, in fact, in The Crying Tree. Ahead of him is the task of making the arrangements for the execution of Daniel Robin, and it is an assignment here from the first page that clearly weighs heavily upon him. Is that common?
Yes, it is. And that's a story I really wanted to tell. I don't think we think very much about what it means to be assigned to kill someone. And all of the very exacting preparation that must go into killing someone, you know, whether it's in Oregon's case, the room that they use, the execution room that they use, that room hadn't been used in years and years and years, except to store stuff. So in the book, it talks about how they have to clean out a room. Well, they're cleaning it out for the purpose of killing someone. They're getting a gurney, and in a gurney that you use for lethal injections, the arms pull out to the sides, very much looking like a crucifix because the person's strapped to it with the arms splayed out on either side. The people have to go through the ritual, the officers have to go through the ritual of getting other officers to lie down on the gurney, strapping them down so that they know what the whole process is like, walking them to it. I don't think we give much thought to what that is like for people. And in the conversations I've had with officers and superintendents and administration officials. It's not an easy task. It's not a task that's taken lightly, and it is a task that weighs heavily, not just for the moment, but for months, days, months, years that go by, that assignment weighs on them. Mm-hmm.
I have two questions left. They're related, and I can give you about a minute and a half. Where do you think the debate is today on the death penalty, and where do you think we're headed?
Well, I think the debate is in a very alive state. People are recognizing that we have put people to death that shouldn't have gone to death. That with DNA testing, we're proving that we're committing the worst of acts by killing people that never should have been killed. We're also asking ourselves, as one of the only industrialized nations in the world that is still doing this, why is it necessary? And we're also asking ourselves, in a time of huge budgetary deficits across the country, why would we spend more money trying to kill someone than we would if we simply were to give them life imprisonment and true life? So I think that there's a lot of questions that are being asked. New Mexico just repealed the death penalty. Colorado came very close. I think that more and more states are going to be looking at whether or not they want to continue to have capital punishment.
There we have to leave it. Nassim Raqqa, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you for your time.
Nassim Raqqa is the author of The Crying Tree, a novel. The book is published by Broadway Books. You'll find her online at NassimRaqqa.com, and she spells her name N-A-S-E-E-M, Nassim Raqqa, R-A-K-H-A.
Earth and Sky.
Today, a Swedish student asks the scientists,
"My name is Adam Bergner. I come from Linköping, Sweden, and my question is, how are birds able to navigate?"
There are many theories, and a recent one came from Klaus Schulten, a biophysicist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He said birds usually navigate by physical landmarks, like highways or coastlines, but in extreme weather, or as they fly over oceans, they use a sort of internal compass.
Well, many of us think that there are two compass senses in birds and other animals. One that likely relies on magnetite, and the other one that relies on a biochemical reaction that is connected with the visual system.
Magnetite, a mineral with magnetic properties, is found in some birds' beaks. Schulten believes it helps birds identify strong or weak magnetic fields on Earth's surface. He thinks birds also utilize Earth's pervasive global magnetic field, the one that guides our compasses.
And that is more the general map that they need to use when they are in completely unknown territory.
Schulten believes that ability comes